From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a woman in Colorado who had checked into the hospital. Dahlia Singer said it had been about 24 hours since she had felt any nudges or kicks from her baby, who was due in about 3 months. Singer said she was so focused on her baby that she was taken aback when a nurse began asking her questions about herself. "How are you sleeping?" the nurse asked. "Do you feel safe at home with your partner? Have you had any recent thoughts of harming yourself?" In a recent piece for Smithsonian Magazine, Singer, who is a journalist, wrote that until recently, mental health was not a regular or expected part of prenatal care. Research shows that a pregnant person's mental health and the stress they feel can affect the fetus and child development. You've likely heard the term postpartum depression, but there's growing attention to what's called perinatal depression. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, it includes depression that occurs during pregnancy and in the weeks and months after childbirth, what we know as postpartum depression. Symptoms include extreme sadness, anxiety, and fatigue, which can make it difficult to carry out daily tasks. Studies show 1 in 5 women or 1 in 10 men may experience the condition, and people of color are more likely to experience perinatal depression than white people. What does this mean for parents and for babies? What kinds of conversations should parents and providers have both during and after pregnancy? Our guests this hour help us understand what can be a complicated and challenging issue sometimes talk about or to simply offer treatment for them. We're going to talk about all of that and more this hour with our guests. And Dr. Kristen Koberstein is with us, a senior instructor in psychiatry and family medicine and associate director of the Marriage and Therapy Training Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center and clinic director for Strong Behavioral Health at Highland Family Medicine. Thank you for being here, Kristen. Great to have you.
Yeah, great to be on.
Also with us is Shauna Peterson, a coordinator for the Nurture Program at Jewish Family Services, mother of three. Hello, Shauna. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you.
Also with us, two other mothers are with us. Lindsay Bonilla is the local mom of one. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
And Leora Rosen is a mom of three. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kristen, let me start with you and just ask you right out of the gate here. When it comes to this issue, I think many listeners are probably familiar with postpartum depression as a term. I'm not sure perinatal depression is a term that hits people as often. So how far away are we from where we need to be in terms of treating this and approaching this the right way?
I think we're going in the right direction. Like you mentioned, there's other terms being used now outside of postpartum depression, which is actually part of that good direction. Within our field of perinatal mental health, we are now using the term PMADS sometimes is used in the literature. So it stands for perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. And it's a nice umbrella term that catches all of the different things that both pregnant and postpartum families can be experiencing. It includes depression, but it's so much more. It includes other diagnoses, experiences, and everything under that. And I think the shift to considering it as a transition into parenthood is the direction we want to be going. And like you said, there's less, I would actually say, and everybody else can definitely jump in too, but I think it's moving in the direction of calling it more of more of just perinatal mental health, actually, is what I see the most often, even in social media and campaigns to spread awareness of this transition time for families and thinking of it as a transition as opposed to just a diagnosis that's only occurring for some people.
So let me ask you what is admittedly a kind of clumsy question, but it gets at the maybe, I don't know if there's generational divides, but when we talk about mental health, for example, on this program writ large, I have been accustomed over the years to hearing from some listeners who tend to be a little bit older, who think that sometimes we are either overdiagnosing or convincing young people that, you know, you're going to be depressed, you should be depressed, everyone's depressed, as opposed to, a very different time when they were growing up. And with this issue, I guess what I want to ask is, what is an appropriate amount of anxiety? I don't think it's possible to go through pregnancy without some anxiety. Mm-hmm. I've never met that person yet. What's an appropriate amount of anxiety, or I don't even know if that's the right term, versus something that starts to be potentially threatening or problematic and needing something beyond what would be a typical response to anxiety. I hope this is making sense. I admitted it was clumsy.
Yeah. So you're right. Every pregnant person and new parent is going to experience anxiety. I think that's part of the awareness in this whole campaign is shifting that acknowledgement of it's normal to feel stressed, anxious, depressed. And it doesn't necessarily mean it's a diagnosis of clinical depression or a diagnosed anxiety disorder. Those, I think the difference between the two becomes your level of functioning. Is it impacting my day-to-day? Is it impacting how I'm taking care of myself or my children? Is it having such an impact on me that I'm not able to go to work? I'm not being the parent that I want to be. I'm not able to sleep, things like that, although nobody's able to sleep with a baby, so that's a bad example. But, you know, so I think what there's a it's sort of a continuum, right? And all families experiencing some chaos, stress, shift in an identity when you add another human to a family is normal. But at what point, because of all kinds of different factors, individual, social, family factors, when does it start to contribute so much that the family is now really struggling? And that's where you start to see things that are at the level where they would be a diagnosis. But I think thinking about it as a whole continuum is super helpful of just this transition is going to impact your functioning. And that's still also okay and important to seek out supports socially within your family with providers because it makes that transition easier and less likely that you do end up more impaired.
Yeah. And I was writing down the term that you used, PMADS.
Yes.
Tell me again what it stands for.
Perinatal mood and anxiety disorders.
Mood and anxiety disorders. Do we know roughly what percentage of pregnant women would end up in categorized with PMADS?
The numbers are as high as 1 in 5, although actually even higher for certain populations. So as you mentioned, Black families, marginalized and underserved individuals have higher rates, but it can be 1 in 5 or more. And then if you start to really tease things out and look at different diagnoses, there's different rates and ranges for that.
Well, saying on this theme, I want to ask Shauna what the Nurture Program is at Jewish Family Services. Tell us about what that program is.
Yeah, so the Nurture Program is designed to support families after they have a baby. So we're not there to support families specifically who are saying they have been diagnosed with a mental health condition, but we are there acknowledging, like what she just mentioned, that there's a change. It's a huge life change that families are going through, and all families need to have an opportunity to be like heard and listened to and held during this vulnerable time. So our Nurture volunteers will go to a family's home and support them for a total of 12 visits during a 6-month time frame. And the volunteers are there to just offer a listening ear to help with practical tasks like holding the baby so the parent can eat or shower, helping with the dishes or the laundry. And then we're also there to really connect them to other resources in the community as needed. So our volunteers have the opportunity to go through Postpartum Support International to do a free maternal mental health 101 training. And that really helps them at least have a basic understanding and the ability to look for what some symptoms might be so we can provide the appropriate resources.
How much does the societal change where we are living further apart from family affect the challenge for new parents?
That's a huge change, and that's really why Nurture came to be, because we were acknowledging that so many people are isolated from their families, from their friends, and they don't have the extended support network that we once had. So the Nurture program tries to fill in that gap a little bit and connect families with people who have gone through parenting themselves so they can offer that peer experience and really just help prevent those feelings of isolation and make people feel a little bit more connected to their community, which helps boost their mental health.
I'm thinking of some of the notes we have and what Dr. Koberstein has said, which is, you know, you've had some patients tell you, I wish I came to you months ago. You've had older generations tell you the stories of the hardships that they've experienced. But we are now more spread out. We are a little bit more isolated. which makes this even, I would think, more acute for people who are really struggling, right?
Absolutely, yes.
So what do we do about that? I guess help people understand what resources are out there, right?
Yeah, I think it does. It starts with awareness. It starts with people knowing what to potentially expect. It's hard to completely feel prepared and know what you don't know, but that insight into this is going to be a transition for me, for my child, for my family, for the extended family. And then in addition to that piece of awareness for providers to be aware so we can screen better. And then with screening and awareness, the next step is what do we do with that? What are the programs? What are the resources? What are the supports? So programs like the Nurture program end up filling that gap, especially if we don't have you know, a grandma or an aunt or a sister that is able to step in so we can take a shower really just in addition to that, even if we have those individuals, sometimes there's also family dynamics that are at play where maybe somebody can't access additional support. So that awareness helps us to know, okay, now we know it's an issue, but what do we do about it? And that's the other important step.
Well, Lindsay Bonilla is, I think, receiving support through the Nurture program right now. Is that right?
Correct.
How are you doing?
Better.
Take me through your story of how you found them in the first place.
Actually, I used to work with Shauna. I also have a social work degree and kind of got to watch her have a vision for the program and build it and bring the connections together before I was married, before I had a child. My son's now just turned one, and we actually have our last Nurture visit on Saturday, which is a little bit sad. For me, I had some anxiety and such during my pregnancy. However, I had pre-existing anxiety and depression, which obviously is going to increase your risk that much more. But really, after that first week of baby blues, I was great for 3-4 months. And then one of those things where we got COVID, we were isolated even from my husband. You know, my parents were out of town, which they live out of town, but they couldn't even come visit. Mm-hmm. And everything just crashed and burned. And that's when Shauna's like, okay, it's time to look at getting another support in place. And so the Nurture program, having someone to come in and just be there. You know, sometimes the Nurture volunteer and I are playing with my son together because I just need a companion. There's other times where they're doing laundry or dishes or you know, hanging out with him so I can shower, or, you know, sometimes it's nice for me to do the dishes and not have to chase after a little boy.
I can recall early days when a solo trip to the grocery store is like, oh, well, I'm going on vacation.
Yes.
How much did that impact your mental health?
It gave me hope to know that there was someone there. And the volunteer through Nurture in connection with some counseling that I had for a bit, and then just honestly just being more open about what was going on and talking, being able to talk with my husband more, being able to talk with friends in our spiritual community more, it just opened the door to the other resources that were available to me, to the other things that could be beneficial.
When we have talked a little bit about this issue in years past, mm-hmm. we have heard from listeners who have expressed concern that the modern social media age.
It's horrible.
I'm glad we all agree on it. I feel like we're coalescing. I feel like we're coalescing around an agreement that social media is terrible. But it demands that you just celebrate motherhood all the time. It's just a joy. It should be the most joyful. How could you be sad? You have to be joyful. And the pressure that adds. Have you felt any of that?
Absolutely. Every mother you see on social media, I shouldn't say every because there's some that are posting some phenomenal real life stories. However, the majority.
Many, yeah.
are posting their smiling child and how they got to go out for a walk and how they went back to work and they did this and that and they lost all that baby weight. And that's not reality. You know, by diaper number 7 on day 3, you're just, okay, can I have a break so that my hands aren't peeling. Can I just take a nap without having to worry that my kid's going to scream 10 minutes into it? Can I go out for a walk on my own? It's social media is not painting the real picture. They're painting this glossed over facade.
And so have you come to a point where you feel like you have a rhythm with maybe with your husband and with your growing family that says, when I start to feel kind of either burned out or even anxious or feeling other symptoms that might be on the PMADS list, that you know how to recognize and you know how to kind of deal with that?
Yeah, I think talking about PMADS, it's a new term to me and I like it because for me it wasn't postpartum depression. It was the anxiety. That was the big thing. It was the, I can't care for this kid. I can't do this. Mm-hmm. And yes, there was depression, but it wasn't the main symptom. And we've definitely come up with language of, I need to step away. I need to take a break. I need 5 minutes for me. And being able to express that while also acknowledging that, you know, my husband needs that as well. However, he gets to go to work every day or has to go to work, depending on how you look at it. He's a teacher, so he's working with students all day, too. But just for me, it was learning that language of how to advocate for myself in this realm, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Shauna, how much does this story kind of exemplify what it is that you're trying to do with the Nurture Program?
It really speaks to what I've seen so often with the families we've served. Since 2018, we've served over 80 families, and each and every time, you know, everybody is unique and their needs are unique, which is what I love about the program too, because we really meet them where they're at. So some families are needing that walk or they're needing somebody to hold the baby, and it's all very dependent on that. But so many families have been able to come back to me and say, this was huge. Just the fact that I could count on somebody coming for an hour and a half a week, I knew I had that time for me. They were here to nurture me. It wasn't just about the baby. They were to hold that space so that I could take care of myself, so then I could give that back to my family. So I hear it time and again, and just lots of gratitude from families. And to Lindsay's point of opening that door, like when we show up as Nurture volunteers, it's giving families like that permission to take care of themselves and to ask for more help and more support through the avenues that they have. So it really kind of opens that.
Leora Rosen is a mother of three now. And how are you doing over there?
We're great now.
How old are the three?
12, 10, and my little one will say not 4.5, not 5, 4¾.
4¾.
Yes.
Very specific. What has your experience been?
Very different with all three. I'll be honest with that. 12 years ago, I felt extremely blindsided with the entire experience. I thought I was as prepared as I could have been. My background is in healthcare and education as an occupational therapist. I was very used to person-centered, holistic care. I was part of a team providing that care. And then it was time for me to take care of my own child and myself, which I didn't realize that I was part of that equation. And I was really unsure of what to do. I'm really grateful that I had the supports that I had at the time. And these types of conversations that we're having today, this was not taking place 12 years ago, I could say that. The Facebook groups that people are plugging into, those were not around 12 years ago. So it was very tricky to figure out which avenue to take in terms of acquiring more support. With my second, I obviously felt more prepared because I had gone through it before. And I knew a little bit more about what to expect. But again, it was an entirely different experience between the pregnancies, between, you know, the birthing process, the recovery. Everything was wildly different. And then I was taking care of a 2-year-old with a newborn. And so that was a brand new experience. But I was starting to learn how to recognize what I needed as an individual, what I needed to parent adequately, and what my family unit needed, and how we could start accessing what we needed in the community. And, you know, the terms shifting or adjustment or normalization, those were terms that I started hearing after my second child was born. And I thought, huh, wow, yes, we're supposed to be adjusting this bounce back culture. That's not real. Whatever. We're not returning to life as we knew it. There's no such thing. And so, as Shauna said, having that permission to really lean into that shift and that adjustment was really helpful in that stage of life. And I really did lean on a lot of supports during that time period. With my third, that was a very different experience. First of all, I was living in New York City at the time while I was expecting my child. We had a medical diagnosis in utero. That was just a completely different ballgame. And I'm really grateful for the tremendous support I had. Mm-hmm. And that might be a story for another time. Mm-hmm. But again, figuring out how to navigate and access care, specifically knowing that I was at risk myself as the parent for so many different potential difficulties, that was really challenging. It was crushing to make phone calls to ask for care for myself and have to repeat over and over and over again what I was dealing with. And even just filling out, you know, some basic screening forms in the doctor's offices, everyone was so well-intentioned, but having to confront different issues over and over again in different ways and being the leader in that, there were times where I felt like it shouldn't be me. Why am I? But it obviously had to be because I was the one who was expecting the child. So three very different experiences. And it's interesting to reflect on the changes over the course of many years. And like I said, I'm really grateful to be having this conversation.
What do you feel like you wish you had known entering that first pregnancy?
Ooh, that's a good one. That I wish somebody would have told me, you will become a new you and it will be wonderful. And you have your expectations. They will not always align with the reality that's in front of you, but there will be a time, it's a process, but reality and expectations will begin to move closer and closer and closer together, and you will find your rhythm.
That there's a lot of wisdom in that, and maybe it's because it's my age. At age 45, all the bands I listened to growing up are now writing songs about, like, accepting aging. That's like, there's a big theme. One of my favorite bands, they have a song about seeing beauty differently and seeing themselves differently, but especially different than what they expected in their 20s or in their teens. And that is difficult when society, in many ways, we talk about social media, that's one example, tell you that, well, despite becoming a parent, you can bounce back. You can, you know, be whatever size you were when you were 18. You can, and that matters, and you should do that. And if you just work towards it, as opposed to this beautiful embrace of this new, you're not an entirely new person, but it's different, and that's not negative. I think different is viewed as negative in some circles as opposed to beautiful, embraceable. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It absolutely does.
Are you feeling now, though, like it's becoming more normal to talk like that? I mean, is the culture going to kind of shift in that direction, or do you think it's still highly pressurized, especially for first-time moms?
I don't have that perspective anymore of being a first-time mom. So it's really...
It feels so far away, doesn't it?
It feels far away. I think that's a difficult one to answer. What I can appreciate is a distinction between holistically how we are as a new person with added responsibility and experiences and wisdom as we move along, and appreciating what makes us who we are, right? So as my children get older, I'm finding new time that I never had to embrace what makes me tick and my hobbies and things that I might not have had time for a decade of my life. So that's not bouncing back or returning to something. That's figuring out how to integrate what makes me me into my new normal. And so I hope that people can appreciate that in whatever stage of parenthood they're in.
I think that really resonates with me. I mean, this idea of integrating yourself into new challenges, new aspects of what your life inevitably requires in parenthood. It's not abandoning that. It's just, it's different. And I think that's a very healthy way to look at it. Lindsay, do you think the culture is shifting in any healthy way, or do we should probably just get rid of social media? Probably just to be gone.
Well,
forever.
Probably.
I think net positive. Not great for free speech. I'm a big free
speech
guy.
We all say
guy,
that but, knowing it's downloaded on our phones.
100%. Are you kidding? Are you kidding? It's all there.
I think it is shifting. I think our language is shifting. And I really like, Leora, the way that you use that word integrated, because I can still consider myself a new mom, and we're expecting baby number two in April. And there's a lot that I'd wish I knew the first time. And I know that I'll be more prepared this time. And yet there will be just as much that's new and scary and difficult and exciting, because every kid is different. Every pregnancy is different. Every birth is different. Every recovery is different. But I think we are shifting the way that we talk about this, and it is a challenge, because when you have that baby, a lot of you, for lack of a better term, you know, goes away, even if it's for a period of time. But I'm still a social worker. I might not have a job right now because I chose to stay home with my kid. I'm still a Toastmaster. I'm still a friend. I'm still all of these things. And I'm a mom. And I think you kept using the word and that was sticking out to me. It's not but, it's and. It's we are all of these things, and some of them are on hold or on the back burner, or we may never go back to. However, we will, and it will look different, and we'll just continue to grow as moms, as families, as individuals.
Well, one thing that we've heard over the years in a number of different parts of our society is that we don't have enough therapists. And I want to ask Kristen Koberstein about this, a senior instructor in psychiatry and family medicine and associate director of the Marriage and Therapy Training Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Do we have enough therapists?
No.
Easy. Easy answer. How significant is the need, and what does an ideal situation look like? Let's start there.
I don't even know if I could come up with numbers, but definitely is not enough trained professionals. But I think the shift culturally that we're also talking about, the shift towards mental health being acceptable, it's I think we still have a lot of room to grow. There's still a lot of stigma, especially for mothers and parents, to say, I need help, or I need to go see a therapist. But it's going in that direction. And that might be one of the tiny slivers that I think social media is sometimes helping around. There is a lot of negative aspects to social media, but the push for get a therapist, it's okay to have a therapist, is there. Although then the backside of that is then there's the demand and there's not enough of us in the field. But I think the other piece is for the therapists, we are getting better at doing systemic and collaborative work. So myself and my colleagues, for example, are learning more about whether it's a nurture program or baby groups or even connecting families to library story times with, 6 months and under. The amount of parents that I have said, go there. It's free. You can walk there. It gets a walk in too, so you're outside. But then you can connect with other parents that have a baby the same age. It's starting to think about community connections. It's starting to think, as a therapist, I can't see everybody because there isn't enough of us, but how can I use my skills and resources mm-hmm. to connect people to other places where they can still get the support and maybe still see me? But if they can't see me as often as maybe they would like to, is there other ways that we can provide some wraparound? And I think that's shifting.
There's some related questions that I'm going to follow up on in just a second on that note, but I want to grab a phone call from Shirley in Rochester who wants to respond to some of what you just heard. Hi, Shirley, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
We can.
Okay, I just wanted to say that I agree with what one of the speakers said about the use of the term and your whatever you are and your mother. And I wanted to suggest that to the person who said that they don't have a job because they're expecting and they choose to stay home, you actually do have a job. It might not be a paying job, but you have one of the most important jobs when you're at home with your child. So I just wanted to offer that.
That's a beautiful thought, Shirley. And that's Lindsay Bonilla who made that remark. So you want to respond to that, Lindsay?
You are absolutely right. That is my full-time job. I guess I should clarify. I chose to leave my paid profession to be at home my little one and to support him in this way.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Shirley. I mean, but Shirley's phone call also reminds us that identity is very powerful, and we have a society where a lot of our identity is tied up in work. There's probably something pretty gendered about this that would bear its own conversation on a separate program. I've talked, in fact, my father's come on this program after he retired, and he talked about how difficult it was even imagining life outside of work after 40 years in the same job, because that was his identity. So what Shirley is suggesting, first of all, I mean, you should have seen Lindsay brighten up. I mean, I know you agree with her point about being that's the job. The way I took your comment was that, you still consider yourself active and connected to a lot of different parts of your life that were happening pre-parenthood. That isn't necessarily all going away. And perhaps in the future you reconnect with many of these or you go back to them. How do you feel about this question of identity, and are you comfortable, with how you think of yourself, how you think about work? How does that kind of enter your mind?
This is actually, let me back up. In previous jobs, I've actually worked a lot with social work students who are interning, and this is a conversation that we used to have a lot in that realm. And so to translate it into now, it's for me, it's really looking at what is that part of me that is non-negotiable, and that's who I am. And for me right now, that's I am a mom. And yet that doesn't mean that these other things are smaller or less significant. It's just that that's where my focus is. And I think it's powerful to use I am statements to really identify who we are. And I think to say I'm comfortable with said identities, I think it's a shifting thing. Some days I'm not really connecting with the fact that I'm a mom and it's hard, or I'm not connecting with the fact that I'm a social worker or all of these things. I think it's not a this is my identity or this is not. I think it's always a shifting construct of where we're placing our identity, how we connect with things each day, each moment, depending on how much sleep we got or how well things are going. So,
I mean, different things will fill up your cup in different ways. And I Absolutely. Really appreciate, Lindsay, you saying that it does change sometimes day to day or week to week.
Because, or throughout the day.
Or throughout the day, even in one day. Mm-hmm. And those other parts of you still matter. The first and foremost, the non-negotiable, as you describe it, is your motherhood. Mm-hmm. And but that doesn't mean that every day you feel like the world's greatest. I mean, like, that's another thing about parenthood that's really tough is at least in my experience, how often you question your decisions, you question yourself, you question, you know, your commitment. I was listening to the New York Times Daily podcast earlier this week. They had a conversation. Michael Barbaro had a guest talking about intensive parenting. And it's not, I mean, I wouldn't, after listening, I wouldn't describe it exactly the same as helicopter parenting, but certainly it is more active. It's the idea that, generally speaking, almost every waking moment of a child's life is a learning opportunity. And are you involved with that? And instead of having the child, if they're watching a show or on a screen, if they're going to do that, do you do that with them? And do you discuss it with them? And do you hit pause? And do you talk about things? Or do you just say, I need some space? And intensive parenting is very, very much in vogue. It's very, very much a part of privilege in many ways, because it's very difficult for single moms, for single parents, for people working multiple jobs to make ends meet. But I just think about that because this conversation, this half-hour conversation about intensive parenting, it wasn't just to uphold it or just say it's better, because it wasn't like this mom war thing or this parent war thing. We're like, you have to do it this way. It was more just, this is where society's gone. But at times that can drain you. That can be really tough. And I see Shauna nodding over there. I mean, like, that's sometimes, if you want to be an intensive parent, sometimes it can't be you who is having that conversation or watching that show or reading that book. And that's probably, again, where this nurture program comes in, right?
100%. I'm, myself included, definitely found it tricky to try to be all the things, right, as the parent. And when the nurture volunteers come over to a family's house and they can sit down and read with an older sibling so the parent can spend time with the baby or take care of themselves, that is priceless for these families, because it is important to them to make sure that their kiddos are connected and being with other people and getting that reading opportunity or playtime. And it's just so many of our families who have multiple kids have commented on that, and how much better they feel that their child had that connection and attention, because unfortunately we are putting a lot of pressure on ourselves as parents to do all of the things all the time. And this layer of support that we can offer each other as friends and or through programs like Nurture can be huge for families as they're navigating it.
I want to ask Lindsay and Leora about this. Lindsay, do you feel like there are times where it's like, boy, I'm supposed to be on the floor with this kid right now, and I'm like torched? Or like, does that happen? Yes.
Can I just go to the bathroom by myself? Can I just lay on the couch while you play?
Absolutely. I'll watch you play, I promise. Yeah.
I'll talk to you. I just can't sit on the floor for one more minute.
Yeah. I have built this train 100 times, and I love this train. It's a great train, but this moment is a tough one. Leora, have you gone through that?
Absolutely. My career was just that. Before having my own children, I was on the floor playing with children for hours and hours every week as an occupational therapist. And it was really tricky to figure out, okay, how do I be present? How do I provide what I know my children need versus what I'm able to do? And I think the reality, for me at least, was recognizing that there has to be some sort of balance there in terms of meeting my own needs and saying it's okay, they don't need me by their side all the time, or how can I set up the environment so that they can. And it's an ongoing thing. I mean, even as my children get older, and I know I'm not alone in that, it's an internal conversation that a lot of people are having with themselves, like, how do we strike the right balance. I could keep going and going with that one.
You have three children, 12, 10, and 4 3/4.
Correct.
Has your approach evolved at all with, by the time you have a third child, thinking, hey, I've been on the floor all day, or I can, it's okay to take a 15-minute break, or, I mean, has that evolved for you as a parent?
Somebody told me along the way that the third child raises themselves. That's not true.
No, it turns out not true.
No, I really appreciate the time that I have with my children. I do. And It's tough, and there's so much that needs to get done. I have returned to work, and there's only so much time in the day, and I strongly believe that the measure of a parent's worth is not the amount of time that they're spending on the floor or even with their children. That might be unpopular. I believe in quality over quantity. And so when we do have the time to be with our children or anyone in our lives that we love, how are we using that time? Are we present? Are we being intentional? Is there benefit, you know, for children? Is there that developmental benefit to what we're adding? Is that their value add there? And so that's how I like to look at it. I also firmly believe in good enough parenting. There has to be there has to be that minimum level of like, this is what we're dealing with today. Check, check, check. Everything else is bonus.
Like, child's okay. Child is healthy. Child is fed. I mean, like, you can't do everything every second. Mm-hmm. Part of the podcast I was listening to had a remarkable statistic to me, and maybe producer Megan Mack can fact check me on the fly here and see if I remember this correctly, but the amount of direct parenting, you know, essentially that reading to, talking to, educational, on the floor with direct playing, in the last 40 to 50 years, in this time where a lot of more American women are in the workforce, moms are spending more time playing directly and parenting directly today than they did 50 to 60 years ago when there was a lot fewer women in the workforce. It's a remarkable thing. But what that suggests is just the cultural shift, this expectation that, parent used to only be a noun, and now it's, you know, there's parenting guidebooks everywhere, and there's parenting TikToks and what you have to do, and, you know, there's a lot of pressure. We love social media. It's just so good. It's so good for everybody. It's just wonderful what it's done for the world. What we've been talking about this hour is a lot of what I think is tied together. And I want to ask both Kristen and Shauna, when we think about the resources that are available for some of the guests in studio who have benefited from resources like this, how do we get more of these resources available to more people? Does insurance cover this? I mean, like, how do you navigate a world where, number one, a lot of people don't even know that some of our guests are even doing what they're doing, or they don't know if insurance will cover it, they don't know if they can afford it. I mean, what do we do with that? So let me ask Kristen Koberstein first here.
So one of the things I always tell people is to just start talking. Talk to your doctor, talk to your friends, your neighbors, your family members, people, if you go to a religious organization, wherever you are, the idea of saying, hey, this is really hard, or do you know of anything, or do you know of any parent groups or clubs or activities or that sort of thing. I think the more we talk about it, the more we normalize just wanting connections and support, the more we hear about things from each other. So that's one realistic place to start, because it is hard to know how to find a specific provider. Sometimes going and talking to your doctor is a great place, but also sometimes they don't know either. So depending on the doctor's office or type of provider you might be seeing, they might have the benefit of having social workers or therapists embedded in their office, but not always. So I think other resources of just connecting to others and feeling okay to say out loud, hey, I'm just looking for more information on things is one piece. And then I think on the organizational side, that's on us to get the word out. Even doing things like this where we're sharing about programs like Nurture is helpful. Even programs like the WIC program, they will offer and share and pass along community information to parents when they're registered through WIC. So they'll get flyers or information on different opportunities. New parent groups are huge. Circles and Mommy and Me classes and things like that. Libraries, public libraries have flyers and things like that. So I think just getting it out there in any way we can is a huge piece of this, because the normalizing, like we're all talking about right now, is essential. to breaking some of that perfectionism or parenting guilt or ambivalence and all of that stuff. The more you talk to other parents, the more you realize, like, oh, okay, I struggle with that too. And now this feels better now that I'm talking with others. So I think that other piece is where I usually start. I don't know, Shauna, I'm sure you've got lots of more.
Yeah, Shauna is coordinator for the Nurture Program at Jewish Family Services. How do people find the Nurture Program?
So the Nurture Program is available to anybody in the community, and they find out about it through their pediatrician office, through therapists, through OBGYNs. But the main referral source has been word of mouth. Mm-hmm. So people that have gone through the program share about it, and social media is a way that happens a lot. And then through our doula community. So mm-hmm. the doulas are huge in our community in terms of offering vital support to families, and in particular, the postpartum doulas. Excuse me. And they will share all about nurture. And I think a big thing, too, is so a lot of the Facebook groups, I notice, you know, there's lots of resources shared through those. And there's lots and lots of different parent groups that are happening in our community. And to Lior's point earlier, when my son, who is going to be 13 in December, was little, there were not these resources mm-hmm. just flowing out, which I'm very excited to see, but they're also not all accessible. Some of them cost money, so that can be tricky for some families. And then there's the time, you know, what time of day is it being held, and where's the location? So those things can be hard to make it accessible for people. But through Postpartum Support International, there is something called a PSI coordinator, and that person is supposed to know a lot of what the resources are here in our area, and that person can direct families to different resources as needed, whether that be community support groups or therapists. I'm really well versed in that area too, so even if some families call and they say, I just need to meet with other parents, you know, maybe they don't need the nurture program, I can connect them with different groups that might be appropriate. But I do know the biggest thing that I see for families is those opportunities to connect in person, sharing their stories, hearing that they're not alone. And the struggle with social media that we see is they're not getting sometimes that two-way feedback and that in-person connection. So there's lots of great resources. I think reaching out to your people in your community, sharing your story, learning from each other. The Nurture Program is a great resource, the PSI coordinator. And just I hope families will take from this that getting out when you can, if you can, with other families is really, really key.
Well, Shauna, you mentioned the community of doulas. Mm-hmm. I want to shout out to the doulas. I mean, they do really amazing and important work.
100%.
When I've talked to lawmakers, people like Senator Summer Brook and others who have kind of done the same and upheld the value of doulas, I still remember someone saying, I don't remember the source of it, but it was like, if doulas were a medicine, it would be illegal to withhold it. Like, they're that important in a process. But there's been questions over the years about, well, are they covered by insurance? And so same kind of question for the Nurture Program. Like, is it covered by insurance? Is it viewed by the system with the level of respect that you want it to be viewed?
So the Nurture Program is no cost. So anybody in the community that's interested in this type of support is eligible for it. And there's also, you know, other programs that are kind of coming to fruition via some local doulas who are hoping to offer something similar to the Nurture Program, specifically to families in the city. So that's really exciting to see that up and coming and to support that. So, nope, anybody is available to reach out for nurture support.
Are there online resources that you want to mention one more time? Anything to find you there?
Online resources.
If people want to learn more about the Nurture Program.
Oh, yeah. If you want to learn about the Nurture Program, you can go on to the Jewish Family Services website. We've got a Nurture page there. You can learn how to apply to be a Nurture family and or to volunteer. We always need volunteers for that program as well.
Well, we're almost out of time here. Lindsay Bonilla is going to have a second child in April, although I hate to tell you this. They don't always come when you think they're coming. But, you know, who knows? As you know.
This is true.
As you know. What are you looking forward to most?
Honestly, I'm looking forward to reconnecting at that point with the Nurture Program. And, you know, Shauna mentioned the child or the nurture volunteer sitting and reading with the older child. Mm-hmm. I long for, you know, watching a lot of moms struggle with, okay, the baby needs to be fed and the older one needs this. And it's, can you hold my baby so I can have 30 minutes to just be with my son who doesn't get my attention all of the time? Mm. I'm also just looking forward to holding and snuggling another little one.
Well, you know, when you have a 2-year-old and then a newborn, the 2-year-old's usually like, Mom, I'm good. You take care. You don't worry about me. I'll just help you out. They're very no. Leora's looking at me like, is that what happens?
Everyone has a unique journey.
My friend's 2-year-old refers to my son as this one. This one's touching my toys.
I am grateful for the conversation this hour, and I want to thank our guests for opening up and sharing that. And I do hope, Kristen, maybe in 30 seconds, let's wrap with this. I had a note from Jerry asking. Jerry just says therapy used to be a dirty word. I think that part's evolving too. What do you think?
I think it's definitely evolving. I don't think it's a dirty word. I think it sometimes is a hard and difficult to attain word. So
that's a totally different thing.
But it's not a dirty word. I think people are now far more open to it, which is great.
Where do people usually find you, Kristen?
Our services are through the University of Rochester, so the website is large and vast and sometimes hard to find.
Our show notes will have information. Yeah. If anybody wants more information on what they've been hearing about this hour, go to our show notes when this show is posted, wherever you find your podcast or audio. WXXINews.org/connections is a good place to start. And Dr. Koberstein is Senior Instructor in Psychiatry and Family Medicine and Associate Director of the Marriage and Therapy Training Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for being here this hour.
Thank you for having us.
You heard all about the Nurture Program. Shauna Peterson, helping a lot of people. Thank you very much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much.
And Lindsay Bonilla is one of those moms being helped by that program. Good luck to you. Thanks for telling your story.
Thank you.
Leora Rosen, thank you for telling the story of your 3 as well, your wonderful family. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
From all of us at Connections, thank you for listening. Have a great afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.